Support for the Marketplace Money podcast provided by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, providing the financial expertise that helps both our members and our communities thrive. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com.
Hi, I'm Tess Viglund. Most of us could use a vacation, but we'll keep working with a little persuasion.
Doing that would encourage people to work longer.
That's Barbara Boberg with this week's Marketplace Money Inside Quote. She says a certain incentive would go a long way toward keeping folks in the office.
Doing that would encourage people to work longer.
So what's Barbara got in mind? Is it A, employers offering free daycare so working parents can focus on their jobs? Or does she suggest B, allowing naps during the workday? It can increase productivity. Or is the carrot C, raising the age for early Social Security benefits? That could keep folks working past age 62. Only one answer is correct, and it's coming up on this week's Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money.
When is a free lunch not a free lunch? Always. I'm Tess Viglund. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
We'll get to the free lunch in a minute, but first, dreaming of retirement? Yeah, me too. But apparently lots of folks are putting it off these days. This week, the Census Bureau reported that one in four workers is still on the job after age 65. But there are those who choose to take their Social Security benefits early, and that means less money per year. Some worry that early retirees could find themselves outliving their benefits. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports on a debate over whether to put early Social Security benefits further out of reach.
Don't call Richard Gottlieb a baby boomer. Born 12 days before Franklin Roosevelt's death, he lays a firm claim on being a war baby.
There's a difference. My class was very small in school. The next one swelled.
Gottlieb, who is a medical education consultant in New York City, turned 62 last spring and became eligible for early Social Security retirement benefits. He had a choice: retire now and take monthly payments that are only three-fourths what they will be if he waits 4 years, or he could hold off and let his Social Security nest egg accumulate. For every year he waits, his lifetime payments go up roughly 7%. It wasn't an easy decision for Gottlieb.
I've lived longer than any other man in three generations of my family. Statistics don't mean anything for an individual, but I gave that some thought.
In the end, he chose to wait.
I looked at what my income is likely to be and decided I was comfortable enough not to take the benefits at 62. And I guess I'll look at it on a year-to-year basis and make a determination.
Policymakers looking at the sustainability of the current retirement system are hoping baby boomers will follow Gottlieb's lead and hold off their retirement. To help persuade them, Barbara Boberg, a pension expert at the Government Accountability Office, thinks the age of eligibility for early Social Security should be gradually raised.
Doing that would encourage people to work longer. It would help the economy. It would help the Social Security Trust Fund. It would assure that people are better positioned when they do retire.
In a recent study for the Center for Retirement Research, pension consultant John Turner concludes the age for first Social Security benefit should be raised to 63 and a half.
You know, when you think about when to retire, you need to have some guidelines. And 62 is the guideline the government gives, saying it's okay, we're going to give you benefits at that age. So there's kind of a seal of approval, a symbolic importance to the age.
But for many seniors, waiting for higher Social Security payments is not an option. They may be disabled or in a physically demanding job. That's why the Senior Citizens Lobby, AARP, is not endorsing raising the age of eligibility, at least not yet, says David Certner, the director of legislative policy.
If you're sitting like I am in a nice, clean office, working another year, probably not as big a problem for many other people who have the kinds of jobs that is really not conducive to just, you know, continuing to work into your 70s for that matter. And that's the tension I think we see in this debate.
And remember, says Virginia Reno at the National Academy for Social Insurance, a lot of people choosing to take early benefits are already out of the workforce once they hit 62.
The more important thing than taking away the option to get benefits then would be to make sure people really understand what the trade-offs are. There may be a misguided notion that somehow they're missing something if they don't take benefits at the earliest age they can.
The Social Security Administration is in the middle of changing the age for retiring at full benefits from 65 to 67. As life expectancy increases and jobs become less physical, raising the age for early retirement may be next on the agenda. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
If there's one thing retirees can count on these days, it's offers of a free lunch. No such thing, of course, but the offers are out there and seniors are falling victim. The Securities and Exchange Commission held a meeting this week to talk about the latest scam targeting older Americans. And guess what? Chairman Christopher Cox knows irony when he sees it.
Of course, the highlight of the program is the free lunch. The free lunch that we have planned for you may be the only opportunity that you'll ever have to enjoy a complimentary meal without someone peddling timeshares or asking you to turn over your investment portfolio before you leave the room.
To find out more about these free lunch seminars, we've turned to Patricia Strzok. She's a securities regulator for the state of Wisconsin. How does this work?
Apparently what happens is this. You get to the free lunch or the free dinner and you're handed a card. And on the card, you provide certain basic information. You know, where do you live? What's your phone number? Things like that. And once you fill in that card, you're free to go eat. And you might get some kind of education, you know, about the urgency of planning for your future. Here you are, you're, say, 65 years old. You're retired and living on a fixed income, or you're about to be retired living on a fixed income. Here's what you need to do to protect your assets.
So what are they then finding they are offered or encouraged to participate in?
Here's what happens. After the free meal, they go home and they think it's over. But in fact, what happens is the cards are collected and the people sponsoring the seminars take the cards and then follow up with a phone call. When can I come to your house to meet you? And that's when the heavy sales pitches begin.
And what are they selling?
They're selling a lot of products that aren't harmful in themselves, things like variable annuities and mutual funds, but things that might very well not be suitable for people over the age of, say, 80 because of certain features of the products. Maybe they're high-risk instruments. Maybe you have to be invested in them for a while before you can take advantage of the features of the product.
Who's sponsoring these events and what are they getting out of it?
Often the sponsors of the program are nowhere identified in the invitation. So say there is a sponsor of a series of mutual funds, and it's the series of mutual funds, of course, that the producers of the program want to sell. But the person responding to the invitation doesn't know that. They just think they're going for education. The other things that we found coming out of these free lunch seminars is that people, financial professionals, they call themselves advisors, but what they really are people who are very highly trained in sales techniques and knowing where their vulnerabilities lie.
Is this something, if I may ask you a personal question, is this something that you've addressed with your parents?
You know, it's something that I have, and I've talked to my mother about it, and I think it's really interesting because many of us have this aversion to talking to our parents because we'll think that they're going to worry that maybe we suspect that they're losing their senses. You know, of course, that's not the case. But I think it's a good idea to stay in touch with your parents and make sure that if they have something, if they want to ask you something, that you're there, that they know that this is a subject that's not taboo as far as you're concerned and shouldn't be as far as they're concerned. There's also the North American Securities Administrators Association, which is the group of all state securities regulators, has a series of podcasts that are available available for people to download and listen to. And one of them is on just this subject, talking to your parents about investing and about money. And most of us realize that after we've made an investment mistake, we're embarrassed about it. And I think it's really important that people realize that it's never so embarrassing that you shouldn't report it, especially to your kids who are really going to understand and can help you.
All right, and we'll have a link to that podcast on our website as well. Patricia Strzok is the securities regulator for the state of Wisconsin. Thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, thank you.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. More housing developments this week. Two of the nation's biggest banks, Wachovia and Washington Mutual, warned they might post higher losses this year because of the subprime mess. And the Federal Trade Commission warned more than 200 companies to stop potentially deceptive advertisements for mortgages. All of this has made it harder to both buy and sell a home. But if you're already a homeowner, here's another option. Become what Kate Ashford calls an accidental landlord. She's a writer with Money Magazine. Kate, what's the first thing to consider when you want to rent out your house?
Well, you need to know what your home is going to get today, and you have to be realistic. Because becoming a landlord is really a bet that you can earn more renting your home and selling it later than you would by just moving on and putting sale proceeds to work elsewhere.
What about the question of whether you should really be a landlord? That's certainly not for everyone, is it?
It's certainly not for everyone, and it's certainly not for every house. If you're in a home that has French windows or chandeliers, things that can easily be broken, it may not be the best one to rent. And you should also consider if you've got a house with a lot of bedrooms, you're probably going to attract families with kids. There's some wear and tear that comes along with that, so you should be...
Really?
Oh, yeah. Not everyone's going to care for your home the way that you do.
And how do you go about finding a good tenant? Because there are a lot of folks out there you wouldn't want to be in your home.
Oh, exactly. And a lot of new landlords will assume that most people are honest and they'll take people at their word. And really, you know, it only takes a few who aren't to make landlording really frustrating. So the experts really say, do a thorough background check, get a credit report, get an eviction history, and call the previous landlord, because if they're really a bad tenant, their current landlord might just want them out, and they might tell you anything. So check with the landlord before the previous one.
Is there anyone who absolutely should not consider this as an option?
Well, if you're in a housing market that's been flat for a while and it's not really projected to go up and you're not really going to be able to charge enough in rent to cover your costs, because the costs are kind of complicated. It's not just your mortgage payments. It's also taxes and upkeep. Your insurance is probably going to be higher because you're not living in the house. There's unexpected maintenance. There might be a gap between tenants. You might even consider, if you're considering hiring a property manager, your projected rent is going to go down by another 10%. And if you're not close to the home, it's going to be such a chunk of your time to go check on that house if they need you. If you're more than 30 miles away, it's something you should consider pretty cautiously.
Kate Ashford is a contributing writer at Money Magazine, and her article, Landlords in Waiting, is in the September issue on Newsstands Now. Hey, thanks so much for coming in.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot.
Toga, toga, stock quote, a college student wants to start an investment club with his dorm mates. Chris schools him in the mailbag. And meet a businessman who likes to handcuff his clients.
If you see me late at night and you violated the contract and I had to come out to get you, I'm not there to give you a dozen roses.
A day in the work life of a bail bondsman. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. Think you can tolerate risk? Okay, try this. Start a business in which you basically lend thousands of dollars to alleged thieves, swindlers, and otherwise unsavory characters who don't have much in the way of liquid assets. That's what bail bondsmen do. A defendant gives them collateral, the bondsman posts their bail, then collects a fee for the service. That is, if the defendant doesn't split for the sandy beaches of Cancun. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we get a price on our heads.
This Portero family, they continually telling me how unfair we were.
It was unfair that he got rearrested. Was a warrant out for his arrest. He was dragged in by the police department, and when I asked him point blank, he denied it. He said he walked in on his own volition. He said he was never had a warrant out for his arrest.
I am George Zavellis. I am 40 years old. I'm a New York State professional bail bondsman.
He said that he went in and the judge squashed it. He said it was fine, Mr. Portero. You're a pillar of society, Mr. Portero. Mr. Portero's a lying bastard.
The fact there's only 60 active bail bondsmen in the state makes my services requested. It's a seller's market. I have a lot of repeat customers. I have a lot of repeat customers' cousins. I mean, you provide a good service and not that many people, they say go see George the bail bondsman. I can't help all of them because they don't fit my criteria. And it's not because they're poor. It's because of their flight risk. If I have to worry about somebody going to the Dominican Republic or to Haiti or Canada, in fact, it's not a kind of bail I really want to do, no matter how much short-term gain there is. I'm very clear to the bailees when they come out. I have a screen display on my computer with a picture of every defendant. If I see you on the street and you have violated, I'll know who you are. And if you see me late at night and you violated the contract and I had to come out to get you, I'm not there to give you a dozen roses. I'm 6'4 and a half and I'm 305 pounds. That coupled with a very aggressive attitude and a sharp tongue and a sidearm is very, very compelling. Last night I worked till 2:15. I had a bunch of clients in my office, some very upset individuals. Their son had a very high bail and the grandparents were here. And after looking at the person's rap sheet, the history, and listening to the grandmother describing how ornery her grandson is, and he's a substance abuser, I actually discouraged them from underwriting the bail and giving me money for it. I believe in my heart of hearts, if he's out, he might not appear on a court date. And if we can't find him, I have to liquidate grandma's home. And although I made no money, I had a clear conscience. 1 month I can bring home $20,000 in revenue, and there'll be some months that I only do $1,000 in revenue because my expenses are extraordinary. My revenues last year was about $175,000. The fact that I'm interacting with people from all walks of life, black, white, Hispanic, sometimes rich, sometimes dirt poor, that is my most favorite thing, helping people who otherwise would be stuck in jail. And some of these people are found innocent, so it's very gratifying. Others, however, with the majority, end up doing some time. Presently, I have almost 700 people that are out on bail. I'm worried about 100. Still a lot of people. I worry about one, it's too many.
A Day in the Work Life was reported by Daniel Weiss.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters.
Unfolding Credit brings us this week's Marketplace Money buzzword, commercial paper. That's the name for the short-term loans which big corporations lend to other big corporations. They're cheaper than bank loans, which makes them a good way to get a quick sheaf of cash. But the subprime crisis shredded the commercial paper biz. Issuers feared they wouldn't get paid back for their paper, so they issued less of it. According to a new report, though, corporations are starting to lend again, leading some to think the credit crunch is easing up. Maybe it's possible to dig the economy out of the trash.
Got a box full of letters. Think you might like to read.
Hello again. I'm your host, Tess Vigeland, and this is the time in the show where we talk to you about all your financial questions. Along with me, as always, is Marketplace Money's economics editor, Chris Farrell. How you doing, Mr. Farrell?
I am doing well, and I am looking forward to the questions. There's always a twist and a turn.
There is always a twist and a turn. That's what keeps life interesting, right?
I'll say.
Okay. Well, before we get to the questions, do take down our website address. It's marketplace.org. Click on the contact button there. Or if you like, you can just give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, and we spell that M-O-N-Y. All right, let's hit the phones. Harold is on the line from Indianapolis, Indiana. Hello, Harold.
Hi, Tess. How are you?
We're doing well. And you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Terrific. Well, tell us a little bit about yourself. What do you do there in Indianapolis?
Well, actually, I recently retired from General Motors, and I've just been involved in Habitat for Humanity and doing a little gardening and biking and just relaxing and seeing what the other side of life's all about.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. What did you do in your previous life with GM?
I was a machinist at a facility called Allison's Transmission.
Interesting time to be there, I suppose, over the last couple of years, huh?
Yes, you could say that.
That would be one word for it?
Yes.
All right, so how's your retirement going so far? How are you supporting yourself?
Well, so far it's going pretty good.
Are you at a pretty typical retirement age, about 65?
Actually, I'm 55.
55?
Yes.
Okay. Well, good. You got to retire early then.
That was the plan.
All right. So what's your question for Chris today?
Well, when I was tying up loose ends about retirement, I called our investment facility to find out what I needed to do to switch over my personal savings plan to a regular IRA. And the customer representative had mentioned to me a plan called the Age 55 Rule, and I was not familiar with that.
Hmm.
And I was wondering if Chris could fully explain just exactly what that entails.
All right, Chris, what is the Age 55 Rule, which, of course, would apply to Harold, who is 55?
Okay. You've heard me say, Tess, Harold, over and over again, you save in a 401k, you can't take the money out before age 59 and a half without paying a 10% penalty, right? However...
Were you wrong, my friend?
No, I'm okay. Right. But there is a quirk in the tax law.
Of course you are.
And I know this is going to surprise you that there's a quirk in the tax law. If you are at least 55 years old when you leave your employer, you don't get the 10% penalty. Now, if you're 54 when you leave your employer and then you turn 55, it doesn't apply to you. Now, the longer you can leave the money alone, the better it is. But frankly, it is a good safety valve for a lot of people who do, are restructured out of a job. This gives them a little bit of a safety valve.
All right. Well, there you go, Harold. That sounds like a pretty good answer for you.
Well, I had another part of that question. I was also told that you would have to leave your 401k there with your former employer in order to take advantage of that. You could not switch that over to a traditional IRA without being penalized. Is that correct?
That is correct, because once you switch it over to the traditional IRA, then the 59.5 kicks in for the IRA rules.
And then you're penalized at 10% plus the taxes that you have to pay.
Exactly.
So, Chris, what would be the difference between keeping it in this 401k and, if you could, transferring that to an IRA? You can still play with the money, can't you, both ways?
Typically, the reason why you roll it over is you want control over it, and also you have more choice. But a lot of 401k plans are good. So this is one of those rare times where it's fine to leave it with your employer. But as a general rule, if you don't need to tap the money, I would still argue for most people it makes sense to do a rollover IRA so that you have control over that investment. It's your responsibility, and you get to put it with the financial institution that you want to be with.
Okay, but for Harold, if he's going to go ahead and do this at age 55, he needs to leave it in the 401k.
Exactly.
Good question, Harold.
Well, thank you.
Well, thank you so much for calling.
Well, thank you very much.
Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right, Chris, let's reach into the email bag. And we've got Anna writing in from Clarksville, Tennessee. And she was listening to the show a while back when we featured Marielle from Cincinnati, Ohio. Remember her? Her husband did not tell her about the massive amount of back taxes he owed to the IRS and all kinds of credit card debt until after they were married. Anna is wondering why we didn't talk about something that the IRS offers called the 8857 Innocent Spouse Form. So tell us what this is and whether Marielle could use it.
Well, this is why I love feedback from our listeners. I mean, it's great because it turns out I knew about the Innocent Spouse Rule, but it turns out, Tess, you know that there are actually three forms that you can file, all of which are designed to help a spouse who is in a similar situation to what Marielle was in, where they want relief from something that their spouse has done prior to the joint return. So you file a joint return, which is what Mariel did, and there's an understatement of tax because of some erroneous item that's related to your spouse. And here's the trick. you didn't know and had no reason to know about the understatement when you signed that return. And by the way, the more educated you are, the more skeptical the courts and the tax people will look at you. It's one other option that's out there. And there's also a wonderful website, fairmark.com. Their language is a little cleaner. It's been cleaned up a bit from the IRS, a little less formal. And again, you can go to fairmark.com and also get a very good explanation of these three rules.
And we'll have a link to that website as well as to the IRS website on our webpage. Look for the Web Surfer feature there. All right, 8857-1099. 8675309.
Did you really just say, did you just really sing, Tess? I mean, I really have to ask
you this. Please tell me I didn't. Well, you don't need any kind of form or anything to talk to us about a financial question, but you do need this number. It's 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. That is our phone number, or you can click on the contact button on our website. That's at marketplace.org. All right, caller number two is with us from Waverly, Minnesota. Tanya is on the line. Welcome, Tanya.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm a pharmacist in the area, and I've been doing that for over 20 years and started with a financial planner, I think, in my late 20s. And just have a quick question about fees and paying a financial planner.
Ah, well, are you using a fee-based planner?
I am at the moment, yes.
All right. That's always the advice that you give, Chris, since she's doing well so far. Well, why don't you give us an idea of how much you've invested and what your planner has done for you?
Well, I have at the moment invested in my company's investment plan as well as profit sharing. And I guess it equals kind of closer to the $500,000 mark.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, what about your interaction with your financial planner? How often do you meet with him or her, and what do you pay annually?
We sit down formally twice a year, and then he's always available to me by way of the phone. So anytime I have a question, and right now I'm rolling over a plan because of a job change, so he's available to help me work that out. So if there's any time during the year that we need to meet, we can do that. If I have questions, I can give him a call. He's always very responsive. And I pay him about 0.4% of my portfolio.
Well, so what's your question for Chris today? Sounds like you've got a lot in hand already.
Well, basically, my question is, I do have a pretty healthy portfolio, and does it make sense to stay with a fee-based planner,
right,
which the fee increases as the portfolio increases, which it should because he's working hard to increase my money, or would going to a non-fee-based planner make sense?
Okay. My reaction is, congratulations on your saving. And congratulations on your relationship with your financial planner. It sounds to me that he's doing exactly what he should do. He's listening to you. You're meeting. He's available to you when you need him. My sense is that you're getting a lot out of this relationship, and it's working.
Chris, is 0.4% a pretty good ratio?
That seems quite good to me. Seems quite good to me. It really does. So, but here's one way, just for just to broaden it out a little bit for everybody to think about. I would be skeptical of you going to a non-fee-only financial planner, because then you're with commissions, which is why I prefer the fee-only financial planner. The other baseline that other people should think about is going to one of the major mutual fund companies. And typically, they have a lot of information available on their website. And a lot of it is very good information. And then your big mutual fund companies will also offer very, very low fee over the internet and over the phone financial planning advice. Everybody could use that as their baseline to sort of say, okay, this is what I can do on my own. And then what more can I get by actually working with a person? And what it seems to me that you're getting is you sit down twice a year and you really have a discussion and you talk about your goals. And so to me, you're getting exactly what you should out of a fee-only financial planner.
Well, great. That makes me feel a lot better.
All right. Well, so does that help you out?
It does very much.
Terrific. Well, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Trying to improve your finances, but don't know if you're on the right track? Well, do give us a call. We'll try to help out. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or visit our website, marketplace.org, and click on the contact button. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. All right, one more reach into the email bag. And Travis writes in from Davis, California, and he's a grad student, and he's been really keen on getting an investment club started with some of his friends there. But there's a bit of a hitch in that, of course, because they're students, a lot of them might be around for only a few years before they move on, move somewhere else. So he wants to know, is a club a viable option? And if not, are there other ways to make some kind of modest investments over the short term? My first reaction to that, Chris, is that if you're in an investment club, you shouldn't be investing for the short term in the first place, right?
Exactly. And I mean, you know a lot about investment clubs. I mean, my quick reaction is people have gotten together and had investment clubs and they develop a relationship. And then as they move, a number of investment clubs have migrated online. Obviously, it depends on having that initial relationship and people wanting to stay in touch. But younger people have had a lot of success continuing an investment club online. That said, and you would not might know the number better than I do, Tess, but I believe it's something like half of investment clubs fail in the first 3 years.
Yeah, a lot of them do.
They go out of business because people drift away, just as he's concerned about.
And it takes a lot of commitment to really keep that together and do all the research and that sort of thing. And some people just don't have the time for it.
That's right.
And I would also point out that one of the examples that we've been following this year has been the Virginia Investment Club, formerly Baroque, as they call themselves. And they have members come and go all the time. They've been around for several years now. And what they do is as members leave, they are paid a portion of their gains. Or if they've had losses, of course, they don't get a payout. But hopefully over the years, you know, you've gained some money. And if you leave the club, you get those gains. You get a portion of them. And that percentage is all worked out by the math of the club. So if, Travis, you think that you might be there in Davis for a while, you could certainly lead the club and invite people to come and go as their futures warrant.
The other thing is to find an investment club in your area, perhaps through some acquaintance or someone that you know, is definitely a viable option. And I guess my only other point is, are there other options for making modest investments over time? Boy, there are so many options in today's world. We talk a lot about buying stocks online. Well, you don't have to be a day trader to do that. You know, you can just be a long-term investor, but buy modest, very small amounts of stocks if that's what you're interested in. No-load mutual funds. Many no-load mutual funds will take very small amounts of money to open up an account. And then we have the options that we talk about, like Roth IRAs, which are just a terrific way to be saving for your retirement if you even want to go longer term.
All right. Well, there you go, Travis. And if you do start that investment club, let us know, because we'd love to come and find out how it goes for you. Unfortunately, those are all the questions we can take on this week's show. But do leave your question for a future program on our voicemail. It's 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or visit our contact page on our website, marketplace.org. Chris, lovely as always to be chatting with you about all these listener questions.
Oh, it was great. And so what song are you going to leave us with?
I'm going to spare everyone and just let them listen to this lovely one that's coming up here. Coming up, why getting down to zero doesn't always mean the end of trouble.
I mean, if you pay off all your debt and then you go home and you start the same bad spending that you've had in the past, you're going to be right back into trouble.
And the future of garbage. Will we ever curb our spend and toss habit? You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. Have you ever looked at your trash? I mean, really looked? And thought about how much of your hard-earned money is resting in those garbage bins? All the packaging you paid for, the leftovers you didn't eat, the Kleenex you used during that awful flu bug? Our trash is one heaping symbol of our consumption habits. It's gross, and some would argue unsustainable. In November, Marketplace Money and other American Public Media programs will air a special series called Consumed. It's all about whether our consumer culture is sustainable. As a preview of sorts, in a few minutes I'll be issuing a challenge to you, dear listener. But before I do, we're going to visit that faraway place where our trash goes. That faraway place isn't so far away after all. Back in May, I visited the Bradley Landfill in Sun Valley, California, about 20 miles northwest of downtown Los Angeles, in an industrial area flanked by neighborhoods. It was the day before the landfill was scheduled to shut down forever.
A landfill is basically the end of the consumption process. It's the end of the economic value or use for any of the products that people produced or bought.
That's Doug Corcoran, my guide and a PR guy for Waste Management, which runs the Bradley facility. We stood on top of a 209-acre, 170-foot deep pile of trash, some of it here since the landfill opened in 1959. It didn't smell, and except for that morning's fresh deliveries, and you can see photos of that on our website, it wasn't a huge eyesore, just a big mountain of dirt covering everything from sour cream tubs to dried flowers to empty boxes of Apple Jacks.
We're on top of about 29 million tons of trash. Each of us generates about 6 pounds a day. Between what we buy and what we throw out and the refuse that comes off of processes to make the things we buy, it all comes out to about 6 pounds a day. You know, you can look at it as one of these trucks that pick up trash in your neighborhood. They carry about 8 to 9 tons. So you can imagine the number of truckloads that have come in here to actually add up to 29 million tons.
6 pounds a day. Feeling guilty yet? Well, technology, at least, has created a small silver lining. Bradley is one of the few modern landfills that collects methane emanating from its pile, generating power for 6,000 homes near the facility.
Where it used to be just trash in a hole, now it's trash decomposing, generating gas that we collect, that we send to generators that produce electricity that goes back to the homes that actually, where the trash actually originated in the first place. Though really, it would be better if it never made it here, to be honest with you.
It would also be cheaper. Corcoran estimated it takes about $30 million a year to run the landfill. That doesn't count what it costs to pick up the trash, transfer stations, and recycling, which is actually more expensive than just burying the trash. Now that Bradley was shutting down, I wondered where all that garbage would go.
In the short term, we see it as the tip of a potential crisis. The population of L.A. County and the surrounding counties continues to grow. With the growth in population, the amount of waste that needs to be handled grows. But when this landfill goes away, there's not another one coming behind it to replace it. And so what you're going to have is potentially have a blockage in the system where you won't be able to get rid of the waste that's being produced and is getting to the curb. Ultimately, if it backs up far enough, it backs right up to your front door.
Lovely. Now, nobody believes that's what will happen. Well, actually, some do. But the issue of running out of places to put our trash is a real one. The Bradley trash will go to other area landfills. But even the largest garbage facility in the country, Puente Hills here in Los Angeles, is scheduled to close in 6 years. I asked Doug, whose business is trash, what he's doing as a consumer to solve the garbage problem.
It's kind of a joke at the house is that I don't like buying things with lots of packaging, and I don't like my kids doing that. Of course, they're grown now and they're out on their own, so hopefully they took those lessons with them. But my wife and I are really careful with that stuff. We make complete use of all the recycling that we have in our local service at our house.
What do you think it tells us about our consumer society that we're at the point where we're running out of places to put our trash?
Well, I think what it says is that we got to do some better planning. We've got to figure out how to use and throw away less stuff. Look out in the future and imagine what is it you want to see out of our communities and out of our, you know, what around us. What sort of industrial and residential planning will go together? And if we don't look at it that way, we're going to find that instead of a landfill, there'll be something else, and people won't want that either. And, you know, it's just sort of a comprehensive relook at the way we live.
So let's do a relook. Think you know how much trash you generate? Think you're a good recycler? Well, starting this weekend, I'll be carrying my household and office trash around with me 24/7. Oh, yeah. For the next 2 weeks, I'll be finding out exactly how much trash I generate and what kind of recycler I am. And I invite you to join me. Doug Corcoran says he will. The idea here is to see if we can get to zero waste by the end of 2 weeks. I have my doubts. I'll be keeping an online diary of the experience. You can check it out by going to marketplace.org and clicking on the link that says sustainability. We'll also have photos and postings from folks who joined the challenge. Ready? Set, hold your nose.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship. Online at kauffman.org.
You just love plastic, don't you? The Fed says consumer debt rose in July again. If you've ever been in serious credit card trouble, and you can count me in that crowd, you're intimately familiar with the guilt and shame and horror that goes along with it. When you decide you need help, the internet might seem like a natural place to turn. Just type debt solutions or debt consolidation into a search engine. Scores of websites pop up offering to lift this weight off your shoulders. But watch your wallet, because sometimes that's not all they lift. Ashley Milne-Tite reports on what you should and shouldn't do if you're looking for some help to pay off your debt.
Former schoolteacher Dorothea Detrinis had more than $100,000 in debt, so last year she went online for help. She found a professional-looking website that seemed to offer the assistance she craved. The site even had a link to a TV news story featuring the company, so she figured it had to be legit. And she says the guy on the phone seems so nice.
We're going to help you, no problem, it's all going to work out.
She signed up with a debt settlement plan. That involved laying money away for each of her creditors until she'd collected 40% of what she owed. When that was done, the company said it would pay her creditors on her behalf. All this for a steep monthly fee.
What really concerned me was that I depended on this debt settlement company to represent me. I was paying them $513 a month just for fees. None of that money was going towards paying off these creditors.
Consumer watchdogs say a whopping fee is a warning sign that the company is more interested in improving their finances than yours. Ron Berry is with the Council of Better Business Bureaus. His organization received 170,000 queries and complaints about debt solution firms last year. He says it may be tempting for debtors to throw themselves at the first helpful-sounding company they find, but he warns people not to fall for a sales pitch in the form of a slick website or a personable phone rep. He says consumers should do plenty of old-fashioned research before signing up.
They really need to compare several agencies. It's a good idea, for example, to try to seek a local agency, somebody that you can do business with in person rather than by telephone. And also compare it with the others as to their fees.
But desperation can lead to rash choices. Sonia is a single mother with an autistic child who wanted to consolidate her debt. She called a referral service that has an F rating from the Better Business Bureau. The service referred her to a company that demanded two upfront payments of $670. Then Sonia gave them permission to take $315 from her checking account each month to put in escrow until there was enough to pay back her creditors. Red flags started to pop up pretty fast.
Oh, I would get the runaround. They didn't even know my account number. Then they refused to give me receipts to show proof that there is an escrow account and that I am making my monthly payments. They said that my bank statement was my receipt.
Then they stopped answering her calls. But she says they didn't stop withdrawing her money. Sonia ended up declaring bankruptcy. Ron Berry says this is why it's so important to do your homework first. He says you can go to the Better Business Bureau website and enter the name of the company you're considering.
You will see a report pop up for that company. That will tell you where they are. It will also tell you if they've had complaints.
And whether those complaints have been resolved. He also recommends checking with these accrediting organizations, the National Foundation for Credit Counseling and the Association of Independent Consumer Credit Counseling Agencies. You'll notice both have the words credit counseling in their titles. There's a reason for that, says Janet Bodner of Kiplinger's Magazine. You want a company that will teach you better spending habits.
One of the things that's very critical that you want them to do for you is not just steer you into a debt consolidation plan, because that's where they're going to make their money. What you want to know first is, what are they going to do for you as far as putting you on a budget?
Later, she says, if you choose to go on a debt repayment plan, it should cost around $25 a month, not hundreds. A company that does not educate clients about how to manage their money isn't just a potential ripoff, she says. It's damaging to your long-term financial health.
I mean, if you pay off all your debt and then you go home and you start the same bad spending or saving or payment habits that you've had in the past, you're going to be right back into trouble.
But after taking credit classes, she says, you should emerge from debt a new type of consumer. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace Money.
And we'll have a link to the Better Business Bureau on our website, marketplace.org. Look under the Web Surfer feature. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
White House officials say the president
and the experts say usually
the Heritage Foundation estimates
like it's going to be the best
they
quarter.
They decide what they're going to charge.
That has some veterans nervous.
It's time once again for our economics editor, Chris Farrell, to help you sort out what's smart, what's stupid, and what's the straight story. And Chris, you know, it's still early, but it seems like, knock on wood here, the turmoil in the credit markets is settling down a little bit.
I think so. I mean, I'll knock on my head since I don't have wood around, but I think you're right. But you know, Tess, when we get away from Wall Street and you visit neighborhoods around the country, it still seems to me that a lot of people are going to lose their homes. So that's pretty much baked in clay.
Yeah, you know, we keep hearing about all these new record highs and foreclosures. But let me ask you this. The Fed is coming under a lot of criticism right now for not cooling down this real estate fever earlier. You think they deserve it? Was it pretty obvious a long time ago that buyers had taken leave of their senses?
Well, you know, it's tempting to blame the Fed. And you're absolutely right about the mania. And that's not just the benefit of hindsight. We talked about the home buying craziness for several years.
Yep.
But now I know it's going to come as a shock test, but I want to take a somewhat contrarian take on your question.
All right.
Without letting the crooks off the hook, a lot of good is going to come out of the real estate boom. Here's the straight story. It's time to stop hyperventilating and count our blessings. We will get a substantial return on our housing investment.
Wait a minute. We just talked about record foreclosures. We've got this huge wave of adjustable rate mortgages that are about to reset.
Yep.
We've got this near meltdown in global financial markets. I could go on and on and on, my friend. So with all due respect, are you nuts?
Well, I might be. But here's my counter argument. We forget about the good things that happen, the mental and physical infrastructure that has been built that actually will change the way the markets work. Do you want me to go through, list a couple things?
Sure.
Okay. I hear the skepticism.
Yes.
But think about it. The cities, the condo boom. A lot of cities have been repopulated. There has been movement into the cities. Sure, there are condos that are going to be empty for a while. There are developers that are going to go bust. But those condos will sell at a good price and just go to the South Bronx. Look at what the South Bronx was in the 1970s. Look at the South Bronx today. Real estate boom. Now, we have seen with the internet and the rise of the boom that the power of real estate agents has really been weakened. This market has been fundamentally changed. We have the emergence of things like Zillow.com. And it was only the boom that brought about products like Zillow.com that allow you to, you know, look at various prices in the neighborhood and do a lot of your own research. Fundamental change in the market. I could go on and on. But I do think we're going to look back at this period of time and say, you know, Americans grew up when it came to real estate. That's what they came out of this.
But at the same time, you're going to have all these people going into foreclosure and potentially, you know, going bankrupt, losing their homes. I mean, doesn't that outweigh any potential good that could come out of it?
Oh, I don't think so. Now, first of all, we have to, you know, yes, people are losing their homes, foreclosures at a record. Nevertheless, home ownership in the end has gone up and it will go up. And the government just released, you know, the recent statistics on home ownership and is at a record level. It'll step back a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, strides have been made. And what we're seeing is a lot of action by regulators and troubled banks trying to forestall people from going into foreclosure. So I think the numbers are going to be less scary going forward than they might have been when we were doing the projections a couple of weeks ago or even a couple of months ago. But here's the real thing that comes out of it. This is the real benefit. The dream, and I mean the dream, of people has been, how do you connect, a neighborhood like Diamond Street in North Philadelphia, troubled neighborhood, to the wealth of the global capital markets, to Wall Street? What we saw is that it is possible. It was done badly. But going forward in the future, I can almost guarantee you we're going to learn from the mistakes and that there is the real potential for the first time to tap into the global capital markets and bring capital into poor inner city neighborhoods. And that will bring about a fundamental transformation in the economic prospects of those neighborhoods. And it is that realization alone that makes the boom and bust worth going through.
You know, I guess my other hope coming out of this, if anything good comes out of it, is some sort of correction in how banks and other lenders deal with the subprime market.
Oh, absolutely. And we're getting all these press releases, and I know you're getting them, you know, from the various mortgage, whatever, you know, about how, you know, we need to do this. You know, it's like the cow left the barn, the horse left the barn, I mean, whatever cliche you want to do.
Right.
Like, great. Why weren't you doing this 3 years ago? Nevertheless, step in the right direction.
All right. The straight story from our man, Chris Farrell, who always steps with us in the right direction. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, suffering the slings and arrows of an outrageous workplace.
The people who bully are soccer moms and great community volunteers and all the rest. But at work, they slip into a role that they think requires them to be hyper-aggressive.
No need to get hyper-aggressive with us just because you missed part of the show. We got the whole thing, including a podcast at marketplace.org. And don't forget to check out the Trash Challenge. Marketplace Money is produced by Nancy Fergali with Rico Galliano, James Richter, Stephen Hoffman, Michelle Phillippe, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
American Public Media.